they don't listen to the needs of Florida, of Floridians. We are at the front line of the climate crisis, and all they focus on is the crisis in the moment of the hurricane and not the root cause. Like, it's like Ron DeSantis sent garbage trucks to Tampa last week to pick up trash before Hurricane Milton and due to the debris from Hurricane Helene. Yet he refuses to see the fact that climate change is the cause for this. And we know this for a fact. And we can see the way that fossil fuels are causing these issues. And we can see the intensification and the heat that's causing all of this to happen. And the way that we've been specifically, even Republican leadership in the state that has recognized the fact that the climate change does exist, as Rick Scott said 2 weeks ago after Hurricane Helene, they still refuse to recognize the reason that the climate is changing. And that is the fossil fuel investment that we have in the state of Florida. And the focus that we have on fossil fuels and the fossil fuel lobby that exists so deeply within the state.
I just wanted to play a clip from the Republican presidential debate last year. All eight participants declined to raise their hands when asked by Fox News moderator Martha McCallum if human activity is to blame for the climate crisis. This is how Florida Governor Rick DeSantis responded.
Do you believe in human behavior is causing climate change? Raise your hand if you do.
Well, look, we're not school children. Let's have the debate. I mean, I'm happy to take it to start. Alexander, so do you want to raise your hand or not? I don't think that's the way to do it.
So, David Wallace-Wells, if you can respond, I mean, we're talking about a state where the governor, many have described as a major climate denier. What this means, and, you know, emblematic of many in the country.
Yeah, I think the story is much bigger than Ron DeSantis. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Donald Trump campaigning in part on Project 25's promises to defund FEMA and cut emergency services and disaster response. We are seeing all of this disinformation surrounding Hurricane Helene, with people posting on social media about FEMA FEMA helicopters shooting down disaster relief, people circulating conspiracy theories about land being seized by the federal government, not to mention, as you highlighted earlier, Marjorie Taylor Greene's suggestion that the weather itself is man-made and controlled by the government. And there's a kind of a grim irony in those who deny that human activity can be driving the climate crisis, but who believe that government actors can control the weather to this scale. I think we're entering into a really dark new phase, reckoning with the climate crisis, when, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, climate activists would have told you when the stuff really starts to hit the fan, people are going to wake up. But I think what we've seen over the last few weeks shows us, unfortunately, that when the stuff's hitting the fan, many, many people are choosing instead to retreat into little cocoons of disinformation and paranoia. And that scares me in some ways even more than the weather itself.
And David Wallace Wells, what's the estimated cost of damages from these hurricanes? You've noted that the costs may well exceed the total green investment in the U.S. for the year.
Yeah, well, the damages for Hurricane Milton, we still don't know. It seems likely to be a less damaging storm than people feared a few days ago because of the path. And that's a reminder of just how precarious all of this is. A storm moves 10 or 20 miles in one direction, and it can go from being a $100 billion disaster to being a $5 billion disaster. That's how much we are already living on the knife's edge. But we have pretty good preliminary estimates for the damages from Hurricane Helene. And those are, at the moment, about $175 billion. That is an enormous number. And to put it into context, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the total green spending contained in the Inflation Reduction Act, which we're celebrating rightly as the biggest climate investment in American history, the total green investment there, the Congressional Budget Office has estimated, is $369 billion, and that's over a 10-year time period. This one storm, Hurricane Helene, delivered almost half of the damage that the IRA has been estimated to pay out in green outlays. And I think there's an even bigger context to understand there, too, which is a storm that hit Nepal simultaneously with Hurricane Helene here in the U.S. that killed also 200 people and devastated the country of Nepal. The damage there was estimated at only $175 million, which is to say that storms of incredible catastrophic impact around the world are tallied as unbelievably trivial compared to the damage in the U.S., not because the storm itself was less intense, not because the loss of life was any less severe, not because the damage was any less grim, but just because when we tally these things in dollars, we actually value the lives and the property of people living elsewhere in the world dramatically less than we value the lives and property of people living in the U.S. In fact, that differential is a thousandfold differential between the way that we calculate the damage of Hurricane Helene and the way that we calculated the damage from the flooding in Nepal. That is grotesque. It is on some level natural that Americans experience a form of climate narcissism and focus on what's happening in their backyard. But I think it's always important to take the global picture and see how much worse those living elsewhere in the world with many less resources to respond and to adapt than we have are suffering even more intensely than we are here in the U.S.
To follow up on that global perspective, in the last months, we've seen the typhoon Babinka in China, extreme monsoons in India, and heat waves across the Mediterranean. And many of these countries have less resources, as you mentioned, to deal with them. Yet the American public is almost unaware of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned the flooding in Nepal, but at the same time as that was happening, there was also a hurricane hitting Acapulco. That was the second major hurricane to hit Acapulco in a year. The one that hit last summer was perhaps the most dramatic hurricane that we've seen in the age of climate crisis. This was a hurricane that intensified from a pretty quotidian tropical storm to a Category 5 monster in the space of 24 hours. And unlike Hurricane Milton, which was projected to intensify over the course of that period, meteorologists who are looking at the Hurricane Otis in Acapulco were completely taken by surprise, which meant that last year that city was almost unable to evacuate. They had so little warning ahead of the storm. They had a similar deluge 2 weeks ago as we were watching Hurricane Helene, and that's a city that is now again underwater for the second time in 2 years. So, you know, these are storms that seem to demand our full attention when we look at any one of them, and yet there are often multiple of them going on around the world at any one time, which is just another mark of what a different universe of climate impacts and global warming we're living in now, already entirely outside the window of temperatures that enclose human history. We are running an experiment, a dangerous experiment, to see how much of the human civilization we've brought with us to this point can survive these new climate conditions, and we're going to be finding out the answer to that question in the coming decades, unfortunately.
Relating to this issue of what happens in the rest of the world and how little we pay attention, comes the issue of what we do in this country, how we build this country as one of the leading climate change, sadly, promoters in the world, causes of climate change, this country, the United States. There's a new research paper finding that in the months after a hurricane landfall, communities experienced between, 7,000 and 11,000 excess deaths, far above the official estimates. In what way? And why is insurance an important driver of what should actually be sustainable development?
Yeah, the paper about hurricane mortality is really eyebrow-raising and harrowing, and it's just been published, and you know, some scientists are still looking at the data, trying to figure out exactly what's going on there. But the basic story is that when a major hurricane hits, everything is disrupted. Medical services are disrupted, power goes out, people's lives are interrupted, and those can have knock-on effects, especially in dense communities where vulnerable people ultimately succumb to things that they would have been able to survive in other contexts. This impact, the researchers of this and the authors of this paper suggest, could account for as much as 5% of total deaths in these areas just from the hurricanes that we're seeing. It's a quite grim reminder of just how deadly all of these storms can be. We've gotten much better at evacuating, as the evacuations in Florida this week show, but we're still not protecting people nearly enough. And that goes for the direct mortality impacts. It also goes for the longer term impacts on lives and livelihood. And that's, I think, where the insurance question comes in. Over the last few years, we've seen historic losses across the insurance business, driven in part by climate change. And in places like Florida and California, it's really becoming quite unclear who will be protecting those who need protection. If your house is flooded or destroyed, who will help you rebuild? In North Carolina, we saw the intense center of Hurricane Helene flooding, Asheville and its county, Bonneville County. Less than 1% of the homes in that county carried flood insurance. Less than 1%. Many of these homes were literally destroyed. Many more of them were damaged considerably. And many of those people living there will have absolutely nowhere to turn for help. They're not people living in Malibu who have, you know, millions of dollars to spend on a new house after a wildfire. These are people who are quite vulnerable. And both the private insurance system and the federal flood insurance system have very, very little to offer them. I think what we're being told by these disasters is that we need to do much, much more to protect people in harm's way, and that many more people are really in harm's way than we thought just even a few years ago.
And David, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned earlier Project 2025 with this presidential election less than a month away and a very close race. What are your concerns about how a potential Trump presidency would deal with the issue of the climate?
Well, I'm glad to be here talking about it today, because I actually think a lot of the green energy transition stuff that has been going on in the aftermath of the IRA will probably continue, because the political logic of the green investment boom in places like Texas is somewhat undeniable. We're probably going to continue building out green energy somewhat rapidly. But on the adaptation and disaster management side, I'm really, really quite concerned. In Project 2025, they call for the privatization of the hurricane forecasting system, which would mean you'd have to pay for good information about where hurricanes were coming. Donald Trump, when he was last president, tried to cut disaster relief in FEMA by as much as 2/3. As we've seen in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, he also refused to send disaster relief to certain states based on whether the constituents had voted for him in sufficient numbers. This is really a recipe for disaster, because in any four-year period, it's likely that extreme weather is going to intensify. And while I do think that the green transition is likely to continue at some speed under a Trump presidency, I think that there'll be much less humane response from the federal government to disasters like these, and much less proactively spent and invested in adaptation and preparation, which is really what we need. We can't only be rushing to the scene of a disaster after it hits. We need to be able to prepare those communities, which is to say all American communities, ahead of time for what's coming. Asheville is a perfect example of this. FEMA has actually, I think, done a relatively good job, all of the conspiracy theories notwithstanding, but a community that is hit without preparation is going to be devastated. That's what it means to be living in a world defined by weather we have not seen for all of human history. And that is the experience that we're having now. The climate that we're living in now is unprecedented in all of human history. That means unprecedented risks, unprecedented hazards. We need to be preparing for those ahead of time as though they are unprecedented, not as though they are just normal weather, which is how many on the Republican side of the aisle want to see them.
And before Manuel Ivan Guerrero, you go, I wanted to ask you, in Orlando as a student at UCF, if these catastrophes, this one Hurricane Helene after another Milton, following up on this question around the presidential election, how it's affected young people in the swing. I mean, we're talking about swing states of North Carolina, the key state of Florida.
It's been very disconcerting for young people. Also, I just lost power, if you didn't notice from the lighting change. We just, like, on air, but it's been very disconcerting to lots of young people to see. And it has been very stimulating for those conversations. I hear many of the people on my floor who stayed for the hurricane, who don't usually talk about the election, talking about the way that this has been mismanaged and the way that this is so concerning, the fact that we had two hurricanes in 2 weeks, and the way that it's affected our schooling, and it's affected, like, the people that we know and our family members that live in Tampa, and all of those things. And that's really had people conversing about the election and really talking about the effects of these climate disasters and the way it's going to affect our communities and our families and our futures.
Well, Manuel Ivan Guerrero, we want to thank you for being with us, University of Central Florida, organizer with the Sunrise Movement. Even though your electricity went out, your lights went out, you shed great light on the subject. And David Wallace Wells, please stay with us, New York Times opinion writer. We'll link to your new piece, Sleeping Through Hurricane Helene, author of the book The Uninhabitable Earth. But as we talk about evacuations and who gets saved and who doesn't, we're going to go to Immokalee to talk about Florida farm workers, and we're going to look at the prisons of these hard-hit states. Do prisoners, are they protected? Back in 20 seconds.
Don't you think it's concerning? The earth is heating up. I mean, we're practically burning. Fossil fuels keep on burning. The corporates are earning and earning. The survival of a race comes second place to the profits lining their pockets. Don't you think it's alarming? Through ignorance, it is our own livelihoods we're disregarding. The polar caps are melting. How many views and likes you are counting?
Do Something by Celia Hapida. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As many as 28,000 people incarcerated in Florida jails and prisons were in the mandatory evacuation zone for Hurricane Milton. But many officials refused to relocate the prisoners and insisted their facilities were safe. Meanwhile, an incarcerated person who was evacuated to a Florida maximum security prison shared their experience last night on social media. Quote, "Power's out in here, and the correctional officers are hiding in their offices while we're left in the dark. We're shouting for meds and updates, but no one's listening. Just trying to hold on and hope this storm doesn't swallow us whole," unquote. For more, we're joined by Jordan Martinez, an organizer with the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons and the group's Hurricane and Disaster Response Team. They helped organize pressure campaigns for officials to evacuate incarcerated people during this storm, as they have for many others. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Jordan, explain what the situation has been now in Florida for prisoners.
Yeah, the ongoing situation, Amy, in Florida has been one of almost complete neglect and fiction writing by the Florida Department of Corrections and various county sheriff's offices, jails, etc., claiming that incarcerated people are, in fact, being evacuated. The Florida Department of Corrections claims 5,600 almost incarcerated people were evacuated, but in the list of facilities that they released, the vast majority of those evacuated were from work camps, halfway houses, work release centers, and in many cases, they were evacuated to quote-unquote hardened facilities literally across the street. For example, Lowell Work Camp, which is part of Lowell Correctional Institution Women's Prison that organizers in Florida with Change Comes Now have been fighting around various conditions. Lowell Work Camp evacuated dozens of yards away to Lowell Correctional. And so we're seeing this fiction being raised by FDOC as well as the county sheriffs. We attempted to help force evacuations in multiple mandatory evacuation zones along the West Coast, and we were able to achieve one evacuation of the Orient Road Jail in Hillsborough County, but Manatee County, Lee County, Pinellas County, as well as St. John's County on the eastern coast, all left prisoners in mandatory evacuation zones in the jails.
And Jordan, you mentioned Pinellas County. The sheriff there stated that, quote, "it's really not possible to evacuate the jail because of the number of inmates," and he instead moved people to higher floors. Can you talk about that?
I think this is, again, part of the fiction that the sheriffs and officials in Florida like to spin to project a sense of confidence in the face of conditions that are entirely unpredictable in hurricane situations. For the vast majority of hurricanes that we've organized around, the actually most dangerous portions of the hurricanes are not the immediate storm surges that might flood the first floor of a prison, jail, or detention center. It's actually the aftermath in the days and weeks following, in which water is cut off, access to food is cut off, power is cut off, medical supplies are cut off. And so evacuating people to higher floors when the bottom floor is completely destroyed, that houses the majority of those facilities that keep the entire system running within the prison, that people need to survive their basic living necessities, it can create conditions in which, as has been reported on Democracy Now! Before, people are forced to drink water from the toilet because they have no other access. And we see this again and again and again in disaster situations. And the fact that they are unable to evacuate people in mandatory evacuation zones, I think, goes to show the complete lack of prioritization of the lives of incarcerated people during hurricanes. And I think we can all agree, if we are prioritizing the safety of our communities, those communities must include the incarcerated people inside that are themselves organizing on the inside to fight for better conditions, and quite often being forced during hurricanes to prepare to protect their communities via forced slave labor with sandbags or in cleanup in the aftermath.
And Ginny, The Intercept reports prisoners in North Carolina were left in their cells without running water or power for nearly a week, cut off from communication with the outside world, and forced to keep their waste in plastic bags in their cells. Mm-hmm. From Helene, your final comments on what needs to be done.
I think the final comments on what needs to be done is there needs to be mandatory in-place rules and regulations during evacuations when a certain category of hurricane is coming in that require and force state and local county officials to have evacuation plans in preparation in advance. And lastly, I want to close with a quote from inside that we have with Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, who are the folks that reported those inside conditions. And we believe it's very important that incarcerated people are allowed to speak for themselves in these conditions. So this is coming out of the Florida Department of Corrections itself. Jailhouse Lawyers Speak says, "We urge the public to understand our plight as people in jails and prisons. We suffer during natural disasters in locked, dark cells, not knowing if we will survive or not. This is not just a logistical failure, it's a profound moral failing. While entire towns are evacuated and communities band together to seek safety, we remain locked within these walls, treated as less than human. It is heartbreaking to think that while the world prepares for survival during a pending natural disaster such as Hurricane Milton, we are still treated as if we don't matter, as if our lives can be tossed aside in the name of protocol. We must end this normalized routine. We beg the public to pay attention and have a heart of compassion."
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Jay or Jordan Martinez, an organizer with the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons, the group's Hurricane and Disaster Response Team. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we continue our coverage of Hurricane Milton and its aftermath, we're joined by Gerardo Reyes Chavez, a farm worker organizer with a coalition of Immokalee workers in Southwest Florida, which also runs a radio station called Radio Consenso, which helped immigrant workers prepare for Hurricane Milton and other storms. He lives in Florida, but is joining us from Las Vegas, where he just landed. If you can place for us Immokalee and talk about what you understand has taken place right now.
Yes. Good morning, Amy. Thank you for inviting us. Immokalee is a farm worker community that was created as a labor reserve. And it is also the epicenter for the production of tomatoes, with companies that are based on that area with production on the entire East Coast. And in Immokalee, we have workers that come from Mexico, Guatemala, Haiti, and other workers from Central America. We are a very vulnerable community that also has been the epicenter of the fight for human rights in the fields for decades. We have been able to establish agreements with 14 major corporations to create some collaboration that has helped us in minimizing some of the vulnerabilities that we have faced for many, many years by working together in moments of crisis like this one.
And if you can also, Gerardo, talk about the radio station. Yesterday, we had on the news director of WMNF in Tampa, who was covering Gulfport in Florida. And your radio station, that is so key, these community radio stations to linking up people and the kind of mutual aid that needs to be done.
Our community radio station has been broadcasting since 2003. And during all of these years, we have had broadcastings in different languages, indigenous languages, and in Spanish, which is the main language that most people speak, also in Creole. And through the radio, we have been communicating all the messages so that people know where to go and what's going on in regards to, in this case, the hurricanes. So one of the key things about our community radio station is that its nickname, it's yours, it's La Tuya, which means it's something that we have created with the community. In fact, the first library we had was donations of music from the community itself. And the participation of the community in the programming, it's very important. As well as the organizing efforts of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers that are what makes possible this trust in the information that a community that is so vulnerable needs to hear to be able to then go to the shelters, for example. People follow those instructions, and we know that in many different circumstances, we have been able to direct people and safeguard our community by collaborating with the community also in all of these efforts. So for us, it's a very important tool, and it is a space in which, you know, we convey the information that have helped us save lives, no doubt.
And Geraldo, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about the housing conditions of many of the migrant workers that you deal with. They're usually dilapidated or poorly constructed housing. How are they unduly affected by storms like this?
Well, this is always scary for us. You know, whenever a hurricane hits on our area, it's, as you mentioned, mobile homes are really, really old. They are not safe places to be. Something that I have seen, you know, is through the agreements that we have established with the Fair Food Program, there has been changes on the housing for workers inside Fair Food Program farms. But sadly, the conditions of vulnerability, living conditions especially, are horrible in most agricultural communities. So what we are seeing, it's, you know, all the dangers of climate change. Communities like Immokalee across the entire state are suffering more than other communities. So we're still trying to assess the impact of Hurricane Milton across the central part of Florida. And we are going to be trying to support those communities like we have done in the past. This time we were lucky that it didn't hit us directly. But we know that other communities are suffering and are going to be needing support that are in a desperate situation right now. So we will be taking steps to try to support them as much as we can.
And as we wrap up, we have 5 seconds, but the major, the countries where so many of the farm workers come from, Haiti in your area in Immokalee, Haiti, Mexico.
And Guatemala, yeah.
And Guatemala, Gerardo Reyes Chavez, a farm worker, senior staff member, organizer at the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Southwest Florida, which also runs a radio station called Radio Conciencia, which helps immigrant workers prepare for hurricanes. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, Simon Fraser University Campus Radio, streaming on the internet at www.cjsf.ca.
Hey folks,